This is a download from the BBC. To find out more, visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.
This week's programme is all about the bacteria that live inside us, or gut flora, as microbiologists prefer to call them. Most are friendly and help protect against problems like allergies, food poisoning and cancer of the colon. But some are not so friendly, with new research suggesting they're behind conditions like irritable bowel syndrome and obesity. Could probiotics, prebiotics or even antibiotics help? Or how about a more extreme option? Transplanting friendly bacteria from one person to another using some of their faeces.
The donor comes in briefly the morning of the transplant and provides a fresh sample of faeces. We administer about 30 mils of the faecal transplant down the tube into the stomach and then remove the tube.
More from the fascinating field of faecal transplants later on, but first some background on the bacteria that feast on our intestinal leftovers. Glenn Gibson is Professor of Microbiology at the University of Reading.
The large intestine is phenomenally well colonised. There are a lot, 10 to the power 12 in every gram, so that's 10 with 11 noughts after it in every 1 gram of contents. So actually altogether, that's trillions and trillions and trillions of microbial cells, which is phenomenal. It's most of the cells in our body, actually. I think the estimate is something like 90 to 95% of all the cells in the human body are bacteria inside the large intestine. So to take that literally, we're all 20 times more microbe than we are human.
Presumably there's a vast array of different species all doing different things.
There are. It's phenomenally diverse. There are several thousand different types of bugs in any one person's large intestine. Some of these are positive for health and some are negative for health. The ones which I think we've all heard of are the bad bugs, E. coli, Campylobacter, Salmonella. These are the ones we keep hearing about because they cause problems. But it is the case that most bacteria actually are harmless and some can actually be good for health. And what they are doing there is helping us to digest the food we eat each day. They're helping to stoke up our immune response. Some of them can produce vitamins, mainly of the B group. Some of the bacteria are very effective at resisting infections and killing off the microbes which cause difficulties inside the gut, as well as systemically.
So it's some sort of, it's a symbiotic relationship. We depend upon them to some extent, and they depend upon us.
Absolutely. We feed them as we feed ourselves. But in return, they offer us a lot of health bonuses. I think it would be fair to say that our lives would be extremely uncomfortable, if not impossible, without them.
You say we feed them. They're presumably eating the same stuff that we are. What is it in our diet that they particularly like?
Mainly carbohydrates. Now, the human body will absorb some of the constituents of our diet, say in the stomach and small intestine, that happens fairly well. And the residues which are left and then enter the large intestine can then be broken down by the bacteria. And there are certain ingredients within our foodstuffs which the body can't digest, but the bacteria can.
The development of a healthy gut starts as soon as we're born. A newborn baby's bowel contains no bacteria. It's sterile. And the very first gift you receive from your mother is a starter culture of her flora. Christine Edwards is Professor of Nutritional Medicine at the University of Glasgow.
The baby is born with no bacteria at all, but of course, very quickly during the birth process, is exposed to the mother's bacteria in the birth canal, and also to some of her faecal bacteria too, very close to the end of the digestive tract when you're born. So you're picking up those sorts of bacteria from your mother as well.
So the baby is inoculated, if you like, at this stage, and then those bacteria, once they get into foothold, they breed and multiply.
That's absolutely right. The bacteria are restricted mostly to types of bacteria we call lactic acid bacteria, and they're very similar to the sorts of bacteria that we think about as being friendly bacteria, which are present in probiotic products. So these are called lactobacilli and bifidobacteria mainly. More diverse flora that you see in an adult actually takes about 2 years before it is developed.
And what are they actually doing for the child at this stage?
Well, it's a very important stage in development because not only is the baby born with a sterile gut, but it's also born with an immature gut, which doesn't digest food as well as an adult does, and also a very immature immune system. So the bacteria are important for fermenting some of the carbohydrate in milk that is not digested, allowing the infant to get energy from this unabsorbed material. But at the same time, the bacteria are also educating the immune system so that the immune system knows how to behave towards infectious bacteria, but also towards all of the proteins in food, which we normally eat and we should be able to react to perfectly healthily. But if you don't educate the immune system properly, things start to go wrong.
What happens to babies that are born by caesarean section? Because presumably they miss out on that initial inoculation.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And often there's a lot of hygienic procedures that go along with caesarean section, which prevent the baby picking up bacteria directly from its mother. When babies are born by caesarean, they get a different bacterial flora. And it seems that caesarean section is a risk factor for increased levels of allergy.
What about the effects of formula milks, bottle-fed babies versus breastfed babies? Is there any significant difference there?
This is a major, major factor. In the mother's milk, there are a lot of factors which really encourage the growth of this lactic acid-style bacterial flora. There's particular carbohydrates called oligosaccharides in human milk, which the bacteria can ferment and particularly helps these friendly bacteria. We then have lots of antibacterial agents in milk, human milk, which helps to protect the infant against a lot of the pathogens that make you ill. So by having these in breast milk, it really does swing the pattern of the bacteria over to a more healthy style of flora. And breastfed babies are much less likely to get diarrhea than formula-fed babies.
And presumably that's a direct implication of the fact that their bowel is full of healthy bacteria, that there's no room for a pathogen to get a foothold, or less room.
That's right. The environment becomes difficult for the pathogen to grow in.
Which brings us back to faecal transplants, using samples of faeces from one person to recolonise the bowel of someone else, the ultimate probiotic. It's a technique used to rebalance the bowels of people who've picked up nasty infections. Subsequent diarrhoea washes out all the friendly bugs, leaving the nasty one with more room to establish itself. A vicious cycle that's likely to keep on repeating unless enough healthy bacteria are introduced to allow them to gain a foothold and compete. And that's the principle behind faecal transplants. Gastroenterologist Thomas Barodi helped establish the technique at the Centre for Digestive Diseases in Sydney, Australia.
24 years ago, a young lady came along, Jackie, and she was so at wit's end. You know, she went to Fiji for a holiday and she came back with this chronic, unrelenting diarrhea. And I think I was the 8th gastroenterologist to see her, and she had seen countless general practitioners. And everybody had colonoscoped her, and we did too. There were some patches of inflammation, and I didn't know what to do either. But somehow, I don't know how, I came across a journal article from 1958 by Eisenman, which showed that if you do introduce new faecal flora, it can actually reverse severe diarrhea. So we gave her an implant of homogenized, liquefied, donor, healthy stool from her brother, Tony, on Saturday, and second enema on Sunday. And then I had to fly out to the US for a conference. And 2-3 days into my being in New Orleans, I called from the hotel and asked, "How are you, Jackie?" And she said, "I'm cured. It's all gone away." And I couldn't believe it. So I called a few days later, it was still gone. And had she not been fixed, I would probably never have done any more.
Thomas Barodi's gone on to do hundreds of faecal transplants since, but it's still a very unusual technique that most doctors have never even heard of. Alistair McConaughey is a specialist in infectious diseases at the Gart Naval General Hospital in Glasgow, and probably the only doctor in the UK doing faecal transplants, which he uses to treat resistant cases of the superbug C. difficile that have not responded to conventional therapy.
The patient is pre-treated with antibiotics to lower the burden of C. difficile in their gut. We admit them the night before we're going to do it. We admit them to hospital and we stop those antibiotics the night before. They're given medication the night before and the morning of to lower their gut acidity, because we don't want the gut acidity to kill off the bacteria that you're going to give. The donor comes in briefly the morning of the transplant and provides a fresh sample of faeces. We then take a portion of that, we liquidise it, and we filter it to produce a watery solution which will contain many of the normal bowel organisms that exist in the healthy donor's gut. We then pass a small feeding tube called a nasogastric tube up the nose of the person who's receiving the faecal transplant. It goes up the nose, over the back of their throat and down into their stomach. and we administer about 30 mils of the faecal transplant down the tube into the stomach and then remove the tube. That is essentially the procedure.
And if it works, how quickly does it take for those bugs, the friendly bugs in the faecal sample, to establish themselves?
Usually people are diarrhoea-free from then on.
You say often. What sort of success rate? How many of these have you done, and what sort of success rate have you had?
I've treated 21 people with this, and it's worked in all but one individual.
How do the patients react when you mention this as a possibility?
The patients whom I've treated have often had multiple courses of antibiotics, often other treatments as well, to try and treat their C. difficile, and they have failed. I've yet to have someone say no when it's suggested, and the last six patients I've treated have actually done their own research and have requested that the doctors looking after them refer them to me for a faecal transplant. So many of the patients that I've treated have actually requested the treatment themselves.
Who are the donors?
The donors are often a relative. The original reason for that was that it was felt that a household, someone who lives in the same household, is likely to have a similar bowel flora to the individual, and that's probably correct. But I think probably aesthetically it is easier for the patient if they know where the faeces have come from.
They're happier to take it from a relative than a stranger. What about screening the donor? Is there any possibility of transmitting any nasty diseases?
Yep, that is obviously a concern. We do attempt to reduce that significantly. So the donor, they have three stool samples examined for bacteria that cause gut infections and also for parasites that cause gut infections. And they have blood checked looking for the hepatitis viruses, for HIV and for syphilis infection. That's kind of similar to the screening that you would receive were you to be a blood donor, for example. But the individuals that I'm treating have often come to the end of other treatments and their C. difficile infection poses the greatest risk to them at that time.
And if you find the idea of getting your intestinal flora from someone else's stool somewhat off-putting, where do you think the friendly bacteria in most probiotic products originate from? Glenn Gibson at the University of Reading.
The bacteria which are used as probiotics are actually isolated from the gut normally, so the gut flora of people or animals. There's one famous strain which is called the Nissl strain, which is actually isolated from the flora of a German Second World War soldier who had resistance to food poisoning in the barracks, and the scientists begun to look at his gut flora and found these very hardy probiotics in there, and that's actually used in the product now today.
So it's the relations of his original bacteria.
It is, yes. And probiotics are meant to exert their effects in the gut, so it makes sense that that's really where they arise from.
So, probiotics are cultured concentrations of friendly bacteria, usually of the lactobacilli or bifidobacter varieties, the types that we get from our mothers when we're born. The idea being that supplementing your diet with them will boost their numbers in your bowel and benefit your health. But in what way? That's a question Glenn Gibson and his team at Reading are currently trying to answer, and they've made some interesting discoveries. But their work isn't just limited to probiotics. They're also investigating prebiotics, dietary nutrients, typically carbohydrates with strange names, that preferentially boost friendly bacteria. Glenn Gibson.
Good prebiotics are things called FOS, or inulin, not to be confused with insulin, or GOS, G-O-S. FOS and inulin are present in foods naturally, like bananas, garlic, leeks, asparagus, artichoke. GOS is synthesized from lactose as a starting material. And after a very short feeding period, these boost levels of friendly bacteria in the gut to very high levels indeed.
Glenn, looking at the research that's going on into the role of prebiotics and probiotics at the moment, what particularly excites you?
Some of the areas of interest for me are quite generic, really. They take the view that many of the gastrointestinal tract difficulties are caused by types of bacteria. And what one is trying to do with a probiotic is to keep these problematic bugs at bay. So it's germ warfare, if you like, in its simplest sense. So that's the generic concept. So the understanding then arises from beginning to unravel which bacteria cause which problems. So the ideas that we have are driven towards acute gastroenteritis, for instance. We work with some of the Commonwealth Games teams, for instance, in the Games in Delhi last October to try and reduce their risks. Because if you're a high-class sports person, you get a tummy upset, you're not going to do well when you need to perform. So there are at-risk populations like sports people, like the military, people in hospitals where infections are quite rife. So anybody, I think, who's interested in trying to reduce their risk of this acute problem of food poisoning, prone prebiotics are probably for them. On a more chronic basis, there's very good research in irritable bowel syndrome, ulcerative colitis, which is an inflammatory bowel disorder, and some incredibly exciting new research into metabolic syndrome and obesity. Even obesity is being looked at in regards to gut bacteriology.
We'll return to the link between gut bacteria and obesity later on. But first, could the germ warfare Glenn Gibson mentioned really help people with the most common chronic bowel complaint of all, irritable bowel syndrome or IBS? Mark Pimentel, a gastroenterologist at the Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles, is convinced that bacteria are at least partly to blame.
Tradition has it that irritable bowel syndrome is caused by stress or psychological problems, but now, because of the unanimous symptom of bloating across most IBS groups, whether they be diarrhea, mixed, or constipation groups, there's been a desire to understand if this is due to fermentation in the gut and whether bacteria are playing a role in some of the symptoms of irritable bowel syndrome. And over this last decade, we've come a long way in understanding that gut microbes are playing a significant role here.
Earlier this year, Mark Pimentel and his team published a landmark study in the New England Journal of Medicine, suggesting that antibiotics can relieve the symptoms of IBS. The drug they used was rifaximin, a type of antibiotic that's not absorbed into the body and which only wipes out bacteria in the small bowel, upstream from the large bowel or colon where most friendly bacteria live. Half the 1,200 volunteers in the study were given a course of rifaximin and half were given a dummy version, or placebo. Treatment only lasted for 2 weeks, but
the benefit lasted for a duration of 3 months. So unlike other therapies for irritable bowel syndrome where you're required to take it continuously, this was a two-week course that resulted in a substantial improvement that had a durable effect.
When you say a substantial improvement, what sort of proportion of the people in the trial got better?
The outcome measure we used is declared adequate relief. This is patients telling us, do they feel better? The rifaximin group had approximately 41% of patients declared that they had adequate relief of their IBS symptoms, and 31% in the placebo group, and this was statistically significant.
And would the idea be to use it as a one-off treatment, or is this something that's likely to have to be repeated every few months?
Well, what we understand is that a certain proportion of patients who do get a response to rifaximin, at some point in the future, they might have a relapse. Studies from Europe have suggested that the number of patients relapsing could be 50% of them by 6 to 9 months. So there is a possibility that patients might need retreatment.
And what do you think the antibiotics are doing? And presumably, they're wiping out a large proportion of the bacteria that live in the gut.
Well, see, this is where we have tried to be careful. Earlier in this previous decade, we were looking at a number of antibiotics and were struggling because of resistance to the antibiotics. So the IBS patient might have a good response the first time, but we soon learned that 75% of patients wouldn't have a good response the second time because of resistance in most of the conventional absorbed antibiotics. But rifaximin, we learned, was quite special. It doesn't get absorbed. And because it's not soluble in water, the reason it doesn't get absorbed, it actually primarily causes its effect in the small bowel. So it doesn't affect the colon bacteria. So for those who think that you need to take a probiotic after or it's going to cause damage or harm to the normal bacteria of the colon, in fact, studies have shown that rifaximin doesn't change the colon bacteria.
Which is interesting because when most people think of bacteria living in the bowel, they think about the colon as that's where most of them are thought to live.
That's correct.
So do we think that irritable bowel syndrome is being caused by bad bacteria or normal bacteria in the wrong place?
Well, the leading theory on this is that it's actually an excessive proliferation of the normal bacteria of the colon into the small intestine where they don't belong. Humans generally don't have much bacteria in the small intestine. So if you have all these extra bacteria in the small intestine, every time you eat, get bloated, they change the dynamics of your bowel function, as well as causing cramping and pain, in part due to the bloating and gas.
And this gas is coming from the bacteria breaking down the food, fermenting it, and producing gas as a byproduct.
Right. I guess the way we think of it is that when you have too much bacteria in the small intestine, this is the area of the bowel or the digestive system where food is assimilated and absorbed by you. And so when you have all these bacteria there, they're actually very happy because they're not getting the leftovers in the colon. They're getting the good fresh stuff, which allows them to ferment at a much more rapid rate. And so the symptoms become more significantly provoked by that.
Mark Pimentel talking to me from Los Angeles. Meanwhile, back in the UK, there's growing evidence that gut flora may also play an important role in cancer of the colon. Ian Rowland is Professor of Human Nutrition at the University of Reading.
We know from some of our studies that the bacteria in the bowel, if you look at them as a whole, you just look at the metabolic activity of that mass of bacteria, then there are some reactions which can generate carcinogens, which cause cancer. There are some reactions which can generate DNA damaging agents, and we know DNA damage is very important in cancer. But they also produce things which might protect against cancer. And I think it's probably the balance of the organisms that are there, and we all have very different organisms, and different organisms have different activities. So I think it's very much about the balance of organisms that are there, and of course that's the possibility that we can alter that balance in a beneficial way to actually reduce cancer risk.
How does your understanding now of what the bacteria are actually doing in the colon fit in with our accepted sort of risk factors for bowel cancer? Can they be explained by acting through this bacterial pathway?
Yes, some of them can. They include things like, you know, high-fat diets are associated with increased risk. Increased meat intake, processed meat intake, is associated with increased risk of colorectal cancer. And high-fiber diets are associated with lower risk. And to a certain extent, that fits in quite nicely with some of the effects on the metabolism of those bacteria. For example, people on very high-fat diets produce more bile acids. And bile acids are produced by the liver to help in the digestion of fats that we consume. Some of the bacteria in the gut are very good at converting those bile acids into derivatives which are much more toxic, and we've shown that they are potentially tumour promoters, that is, they assist the development of cancer. We know that meat can increase the levels of compounds called nitrosa compounds in the large bowel. And again, we've shown that it's bacteria that can convert those precursors in the meat to nitrosa compounds.
Have we taken this on to the next stage in that looking at ways of altering the population of the bowel has some impact on the incidence of bowel cancer?
Yes, we've done a lot of studies here in terms of potential probiotics and prebiotics to actually reduce cancer risk. Now, the evidence is pretty strong if you look at animal studies and in vitro studies for the preventive effects of probiotics and prebiotics. When you come on to looking at trying to get evidence from humans, it becomes a lot more difficult. We've conducted one very large European study where we fed people a mixture of two different probiotics and a prebiotic and had a control group that weren't given the pro and prebiotics. And we looked at various biomarkers of susceptibility to cancer. And we found changes, for example, in DNA damage. And we know that DNA damage to genetic material is very important in the initiation and progression of colon cancer. So we found that by giving pro and prebiotics, it was possible to reduce the level of DNA damage in tissue samples taken from the colon of these people. We also found that in the subjects given the pro and prebiotics, they had a lower rate of cell proliferation, cell multiplication in the colon, and high levels of cell proliferation in the colon are associated with increased cancer risk. I mean, it's not cancer as an endpoint, but it would indicate that pro and prebiotics are doing something that might be helpful in preventing cancer.
Another exciting area of ongoing research is the recent discovery that obese people often have different types of bacteria in their bowel. Could gut flora influence your odds of being overweight? Mark Pimentel in Los Angeles has been looking at a species of bacteria that produce the gas methane.
There began to be some literature in animal studies suggesting that methane types of bacteria in the intestine could be a predisposing factor to obesity. Methane-producing bacteria, when they're present, they metabolize food products differently and liberate more calories, at least that's the theory. But actually, what we found is that methane gas that's produced by these bacteria actually slow the gut down by 60-70%. And by slowing the gut down, we found it was associated with significant constipation, and we have a number of studies on this. So the extension of that slowing of the gut is you have more slowing, therefore you have more time to absorb food. And so my hypothesis is that the more time to absorb food means for every meal, you get slightly more calories as a result. So these are the things that we're working on now, and we have a number of studies that are demonstrating this association between these methane bacteria and a greater body mass.
And how can you identify whether someone contains more than their fair share of these methane-producing bugs?
Well, we do a breath test. A breath test is very reliable for methane, and the patients are either positive or they're not positive. And we can tell on the breath by analyzing the gas from their breath, because methane is not produced by humans. It's only produced by bacteria and principally in the gut.
So this methane is produced in the gut, absorbed into the blood, and then blown off via the lungs. That's how you're picking it up?
That's how we're picking it up, yeah, exactly.
And you found a correlation between the people who are excreting methane and they tend to be more obese than people who don't.
Right. In a study, we took patients whose body mass index was greater than 30. And that is generally believed to be the cutoff point for patients who are of excess body fat. And among that group, when we actually measured their breath samples, we found that patients who had methane on their breath had 40 pounds greater body fat and weight as compared to those who did not have methane on their breath.
Do we know why these patients have this particular type of bacteria living in their bowel? Could it be that they're obese and the link is the other way around?
Well, you know, what we're looking at is whether diet influences these bacteria and therefore it's a consequence of diet rather than a primary cause, or whether it's a consequence of the gas and the methane bacteria themselves. And we're demonstrating some interesting results, which unfortunately I can't discuss yet because they haven't been made public at the research fora yet. But I think we'll have answers on that within the next year.
Back at Reading University, Glenn Gibson's team is testing whether they can influence weight gain by altering gut flora.
We're doing a trial right now with a prebiotic, but the trial is going to have to last a long time. It's a year-long trial, because if you're looking at something like weight management, you need to do it for a long time. So unfortunately, the results are a long way off, but given our results in the laboratory, we're fairly confident of some success.
One of the problems that I see as somebody with a sort of foot in both camps, really, is on the one hand we have the public and this concept of probiotics are good for your general health, and yet I see researchers like yourself working on very specific conditions with very specific bacteria. Mm-hmm. Are you worried about this sort of generalisation that's going on in the public mind, that probiotics can do everything for everybody? Because that's obviously not the case.
Very much so. I'm also very worried about how the products are advertised. You know, you switch on the TV and you see things about well-being and bloating and I feel better, and you think, well, this is actually a little bit nebulous. This is not really telling us what pro and prebiotics can do. But the science tells us they can do a lot. And I think something needs to come together there, such that if the research hangs together and adds up, the claims should be made such that people understand exactly what they are getting with these products, rather than something a little bit wishy-washy.
Professor Glenn Gibson reminding us that exciting though probiotics may be, they're certainly no panacea. This is the last in the current series, but Case Notes will be back in 6 weeks for another run, so do email ideas for subjects that you'd like us to cover. You can reach the team via the website at bbc.co.uk/radio4 or directly via case.notes@bbc.co.uk. Until next time, goodbye.
If you've enjoyed this programme, you might like to try other Radio 4 podcasts, including Start the Week, lively discussions chaired by Andrew Marr, and a weekly highlight from Radio 4's evening arts programme, Front Row. To find out more, visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.